Thank you. May it please the court. The appellant Stephen Veal believes that it is clear that the dispositive certain fact dominating this appeal is that the old Developer Place Association dissolved in 1992. That fact, we believe, leads inescapably to several legal results that in effect wrap up this appeal and should require this court to reverse the trial court's entry of summary judgment in favor of the respondent, the new Developer Place Association. What ends up happening is that under the statute that governed the corporate forfeiture that occurred in 1992, as of 2002, when it's in the middle of what should be a winding up period, any opportunity that the old DPA had to assign its rights was lost. And what that means then is that under the case...
Does the statute actually say that? Does the statute actually say that, or what's the 10-year period?
No, it does not. What the statute says is that you cannot rescind the forfeiture.
After 10 years.
Right.
So what happens to the individual? I think the argument, and I know there's some loose language in different places about the association versus individuals, but can you continue a winding? Is there anything that addresses whether you can continue a winding up? And does the authority to wind up, if it continues past the 10 years, does that include any authority of assignment or to do new things or to continue to operate as a regular association?
Your Honor, I think that's kind of an interesting conceptual question that I can understand that the highest court of the state would want to consider, and that this case might provide the opportunity to examine that. It seems to us that the answer is that, first of all, we have case law establishing that after that 10-year period, an assignment is ineffective. So we think that that should be accepted, at least as to that statute that no longer has any effect because it's been replaced by a new statute.
Well, the statute deals only with rescission. It doesn't deal anything at all with the authority to wind up. So how does that statute have any impact on this issue?
Well, according to the case law that we've cited in the brief, it certainly does. With respect to... Let me make sure I finish up on one point. The result that the case law reaches does not lead to an unacceptable anomaly, in my opinion. What it means is that if you want to create a new association, for example, after that 10-year period is over, that can be done. You just need to start again, readopt, or create new documents that mimic what was done before. You can't simply assign because that is not part of a natural, may not be part of a natural winding up process. With respect to whether or not that winding up period can go on and other things can be accomplished, although that question may not be before this court directly, I think I'm being asked it in effect. For example, one thing that would come to mind is, what if you had a corporate entity that owned real estate and you have the 10-year period lapsed? Does that mean then that after that 10-year period, the corporation can't convey that real estate? No, I think that's not the answer. That winding up period could go on as far as that goes. But insofar as you're talking about the lapse of the 10-year period and then having an assignment to, in effect, create a mirror image entity, apparently, it seems logical that you cannot do that. That is not
so. Your argument is that that you can only do things that are naturally a part of a winding up process, and that while disposing of property might be an assignment of all the rights of the first association, would be too proactive in effect. Or is there anything that defines what's appropriate for winding up and what's not?
Well, I think if you look at the terms of the statute, what it contemplates is an end. Okay. And I'm not sure that the assignment, which is in effect creating an alter ego, which was what was done in this instance, is the same thing. As the new DPA didn't create any new documents, it just borrowed what the old one had. That doesn't seem to be... Just to finish the thought. That, to me, does not sound like winding up. It seems like a way of avoiding what the statutes contemplate, which is you are ending. If you could do that, then forfeiture would, in effect, have no purpose. The forfeiture says you're supposed to wind up. Well, it's an easy kind of backdoor way of avoiding the statute if you can just create an assignment and have the very same entity existing the next day.
Could the existing directors of the original corporation have tried to collect this debt that was so-called assigned?
Well, there are reasons in this case, in the abstract, perhaps that would be true. But in this case, of course, we take the position that the governing documents make it absolutely apparent that it could not, because what was going on was that the declaration was being misapplied in that these assessments were not being utilized for the permissible purpose. We've covered that extensively in the brief, but that's
specific. Was that raised in the trial court?
I think it was, by virtue of the lack of authority. Again,
specifically that the funds collected were being misspent. Was that raised at all in the trial?
Yes, it was. I believe that there are places in the record where there was a specific debate as to whether or not these assessments, and in terms of the depositions that were part of the record below, in terms of whether the assessments were actually being utilized for purposes, this would be the annual normal assessment, whether these funds were being utilized for the proper purposes under the declaration, which limited the utilization of those revenues for acquiring new properties. And I think that...
But is that a different issue, though, than they made donations to a child care center?
I'm sorry. I think it's the same issue. It's the flip side. I think these are flip sides of the same issue. There's no indication that they were acquiring properties, which was the permissible application of the annual assessment revenues. I believe that there was, as we've cited in our brief, there was evidence in the trial court as to the improper application of these revenues, such as donations, purchases of Christmas wreaths, things of that nature.
How do you respond to their claim that there was a Scrivener's error in it being 2 versus 3?
Well, we've outlined in our briefs, I think, fairly exhaustively, why that does not make sense on its face. We think that if you look at the declaration and within the four corners of the declaration, the plain language makes sense in terms of the way the declaration reads as a whole. But secondly, in order for, ironically, of course, we take the position that this really wasn't raised in the trial court. We shouldn't be arguing about it now. We are aware that there's a principle that in cases of this type, arguably, you can make points that, you can affirm on any basis supported by the record. But here, this is an entirely new claim, and it requires additional evidence. For a Scrivener's error to apply, you have to have clear, cogent, and convincing evidence that there was a mutual mistake. This record is barren of any evidence that there was any mutuality of mistake that would support a Scrivener's error revision of a...
Go ahead. Why did the corporation get dissolved and all of that? Why did it go defunct and then another one take its place?
Well, I'm not sure that the record really establishes why that occurred. It looks as though it was a function of oversight, actually, that nobody was kind of minding the store. We think that it's actually kind of emblematic of the way this organization was kind of running amok. As a matter of fact, this was not what one would consider to be the type of democratic organization that you would hope for in terms of a neighborhood association. But
it's not really an association. It's really a mandatory. I mean, association implies that you can either join or not join, but it is a mandatory community, if you will.
It is, and we find that is, obviously, as the appellant points out repeatedly in the brief, this was not something that he had agreed to join, and now suddenly he is, again, putting aside what we think is a fairly weak position that by virtue of having paid one round of these assessments, somehow the respondent acquiesced to them. That is not true. The appellant acquiesced to them. Stephen Veal did not acquiesce to this at all. This is a situation in which you have a limited group of people who are simply doing what they want to do with revenues that are extracted from people mandatorily, when there are a lot of corporate, a lot of formalities that are not being observed, and there's no assurance that this association is doing with its revenues what the declaration clearly required it to do. So this is an instance in which, as applied to the facts of this case, the appellant, and he is here today, he would be angry with me if I didn't point out that this is not very democratic, that in fact we have an association here that was not complying with legal requirements and in fact was disregarding its fiduciary obligations in terms of expending monies in a way that was consistent with its corporate purposes.
When the association recorded its lien against its property, at that point, they hadn't even received the assignment. Is that true?
That's true.
And so what effect does that have on the on their
well,
lien?
Well, yeah. I mean, actually, as to part of this case, you have two different parts of the case. As to the 2005 activities, there is no retroactive blessing. Even if we were to concede that the assignment in 2006 were valid, we think there's a lack of evidence. I mean, there's no indication of what was done to basically make this assignment work from the original, you know, the old DPA to the new DPA, whether there was observance of the bylaws, requirements, corporate formalities. You know, we just have a blank affidavit from Bruce Mills. But the practical reality is, even if that assignment were valid, everything predating that 2006 assignment was it's inappropriate to have summary judgment in favor of the new DPA, and that part of the trial court's judgment would have to be reversed even if the assignment in 2006 were deemed valid by this court.
Just a quick question. We're talking about the assignment. Who purportedly signed? Once the corporation was dissolved and it could act through, or the association, but it could act through its trustees, is that there's three?
I'm sorry, I just had to hear.
Once the charter, I'm not using the right terms, charter was forfeited, once payment was no longer made and you had that 10-year period where before it could not reverse its dissolution, who could act on its behalf? It was the three officers
Yes.
During that period to wind it up? And was it the three officers who signed the assignment, or was it the association, even though it was past the 10 years? Or who allegedly signed the assignment? Did the assignment in 2006?
I believe that this was a simple statement by Bruce Mills, who was one of the officers from that period of time, who indicated that he had signed it.
We don't actually have a copy of the assignment.
An officer wouldn't have the authority to sign anything for a rescinded corporation, would it?
Our point overall on that point is that there's a complete lack of evidence in the record as to what was done to make this.
It's summary judgment, is it not? And so did you, in response to the motion for summary judgment, raise that issue?
Well, we think we did. First of all, this assignment was not pled. We believe it had to be pled. None of the petitions ever mentioned it. It first came about in this very summary form in the summary judgment record. We consistently indicated that the new DPA had no authority. So I think affirmatively, and that those were raised as affirmative defenses. Certainly, if the respondent were confused as to the breadth of that affirmative defense, it could have moved for a more definite statement. That wasn't done. Consistently, the appellant at the trial court level indicated that there was no authority. In effect, he got sandbagged because there was no mention of the assignment in any of the pleadings. And so, therefore, we believe we did everything necessary or appropriate at the trial.
Of course, opposing counsel cites to your admission or agreement to the facts stated in the summary judgment motion that there was an assignment. And I take it you're saying it was – I know you disagree on whether you meant it was legal. You were just saying factually it occurred. Is there any precedent on how we deal with that kind of situation or that kind of conflict into what was meant by that admission?
Well, Unfortunately, Your Honor, I don't have a case directly dealing with that. But let me, first of all, the Court of Appeals agreed with our position, obviously. I understand that that opinion is no longer, it's no longer an opinion. It's no longer binding on anyone. However, you know, our reasoning did convince it. If one were to admit, in response to a summary judgment motion, that a contract had been executed, I don't think that that would foreclose arguments as to reasons why that contract was no, you know, failed of consideration, things of that nature. I don't think that an admission as to the existence of a document forecloses anyone, forecloses the maker of that admission from then challenging the legal efficacy of the document that is confronting him.
Thank you.
The appellant requests that this court, in its opinion, reverse the summary judgment entered in favor of the respondent at the trial court level. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. It's an honor for me to be here and argue in front of all of you. I just want to state first, I want to address some of the answers that were given by Mr. Elkin. So some of your questions. Mr. Elkin was asked whether or not it was raised in the trial court that the assessments were to only be used for acquiring properties, and no, it was never raised in the trial court. It was never raised in the summary judgment. It was never raised as a defense, in an affirmative defense. Never was it raised.
He defends that because he says that you didn't even plead that the assignment was made.
Well, that, okay, that's the assignment issue. I'll get to that in a second, and I appreciate that. But this is the issue of where he says that there was a winding down period, and you cannot wind down, collect assessments, and use it to acquire property, which is what the indenture says is all the assessments can be used for. That's his argument, and my position is, and it is, that the, first of all, that the appellant never did raise that issue at all. Judge Durker never saw that. It was never involved in the case. And you can read that yourself because the summary judgment record is very clear.
Well, I said lack of authority to do this. I mean, whether he said because of that reference and, you know, that particular subsection, that, how specifically do you have to raise something in order to preserve it?
Well, I think a short and plain statement of fact, which is what the rules require, I think would have sufficed at that time.
Was the indenture itself a part of the summary judgment pleading?
Yes, it was.
Well, don't we assume that the judge reads the attachments? And if he read the indenture itself and it said that that was the only thing the funds could be used for, why isn't that sufficient to put it in issue, just like if we were putting an insurance contract in issue at a summary judgment?
The summary judgment rules require that each of the parties will put forth uncontroverted facts to support their positions. So the judge really isn't required to read every word of every document and exhibit that's attached unless it somehow goes to those uncontroverted facts so he can make sure that those facts are in fact correct. And then the opposing counsel then has an opportunity to submit his own uncontroverted facts that he can say are either true or false, and then I would have the opportunity to respond to that with citings to documents, affidavits, or depositions to say, no, that's not true because here is support for my position. And those uncontroverted facts are set forth in the rules, and that's how we establish our motions for summary judgment. So those facts are set forth for the judge.
Isn't it a legal issue whether the assignment's valid and whether it gives you authority, though, as opposed to a factual issue that it was signed?
Let's go to and let's deal with the assignment. Mr. Elkin kept referring to it as basically he admitted to the existence of the assignment. No, he didn't. No, the admission is it's specifically stated that the old DPA assigned all of its rights, title, and interest to the new DPA.
And you're...
That's what it says.
You're arguing that that's different than saying they executed a document called an assignment.
That's correct.
And does it matter if... I mean, did the DPA still exist at the time and they had authority and those kind of things? Those kind of all fall by the wayside?
Good question, Judge Stith. The issue is we have a... Well, again, the statute doesn't have a statute of limitations for the former officers and directors of a corporation to wind down the business. There's no statute of limitations for
that. You point out in your brief there was. And what did the old statute say that was?
The old statute had, it basically asked for some expedience If you were voluntarily dissolved, this is an involuntarily dissolved corporation because they failed to file their registration with the Secretary of State, so they were involuntarily dissolved. They forfeited their charter by virtue of the Secretary of State's order.
Do you argue it's a reasonable test or that it's just indefinite?
There is no test in the statute. All right, this court would have to impose one at this point if they wish to do so. However, if you look at the case of Pioneer Point, and that's part of why we're here today, I mean, Pioneer Point was out of the Southern District. That case clearly allowed for a signing by a involuntarily dissolved corporation, the Homeowners Association won. That was dissolved, and 12 years later, they said, no, this assignment is fine. They assigned their rights to Homeowner Association 2.
The timeliness wasn't raised in Pioneer Point, was it?
I didn't read the briefs. I don't know if it was or not. All I know is that the opinion of the court was that the assignment was valid. It was valid for a period of 12 years dissolving.
Mr. Berkowitz, was the assignment in this case, it does say in the admission, the association, but if I understand correctly, this is more than 10 years after it was administratively dissolved, so the association could not have been reinstated. The association didn't exist to do an assignment, did it? The officers may or may not have had authority in winding it up, but there was no it's not clear to me that the admission, if there is one, or agreement to the fact or whatever, goes to that issue or where the authority rises for, the association didn't exist anymore. It had to be the officers or
right.
What?
The association as a company no longer existed. Okay, it could not exist, but the officers and directors are, it's their duty to take and preserve the assets that still remain. It's their duty to do that preservation. And now, my appellant doesn't seem to have a problem if the purpose for the assessment is to continue to pay for security and social service and all the good things that happen in this neighborhood. That's not. But what he's saying is it's to accumulate property, so the winding down period is.
My question was different. But going to that,
former officers and directors are charged with the responsibility to deal with the assets.
But my point is the record doesn't show the assignment was by the former officers and directors.
Yes, it does.
Okay, that's not in anything.
The assignment, and it is attached to it, okay. Someone asked, do we have it? Yes, you do. It was attached to the summary judgment motion. I can't find it right real quick right now. But it's attached. It's in the legal file.
And it's in the name of the officers and directors.
Bruce Mills was the president of the old DPA.
Yes.
And he signed it, and it says right in there that that's who he is.
Doesn't the statute
certifies to it?
Don't the statutes require that the directors, the former directors,
are trustees?
They are trustees of the assets of the corporation.
Do all three have to do
so
it?
No,
there's no rule that all three have.
What can the president do then, if the president of the corporation, if the statute?
He's a former officer. He's okay. The president, and he's entitled to deal with the assets of the corporation.
What gives a former president of a rescinded corporation the authority to sign anything?
The statute. The statute says specifically that those former officers are trustees for the purpose of winding down the business and preserving the assets, and there's no statute limitations for that.
Is there any difference between operating an association during a winding-up period and operating it in a regular time when you're not
That's a great question.
Dissolved?
Thank you for that. Which leads to something I need to discuss slightly with all of you. Looking at this situation as an association, as you would consider a not-for-profit, that it started for the purpose of, whether it be the Kidney Foundation or some other really good non-for-profit, you know, a charitable organization. Community associations are different. Community associations, the association is a tool. It's not what starts the business of the covenants and restrictions. The covenants and restrictions are created by the developer. He's the one who files the recorded documents. He's the one that sets the rules. And under those recorded documents, there is supposed to be an association which will help manage and administer the covenants and restrictions. And so in these kinds of cases of community organizations, what we really want to do is affect the intent of the developer. The intent of the developer here was to maintain this neighborhood because that was the expectation of all of the members. The members are these owners. Their expectation is that they're going to live in a neighborhood that's going to have these services. There's going to be beautification. There's going to be child care. There's going to be social service. There's going to be security. There'll be services rendered, whether it be a dog park or a pool, which this has. You're going to be in a situation where you want to affect the intent of the developer and make sure that these covenants and restrictions carry on. The association, and I don't want to say that this is just a minuscule, no big deal situation. I mean, they should have upped with the Secretary of State each year, no question about that.
I mean, it's the situation here that they did not realize they'd been dissolved until after the 10-year period,
that's
so they had operated the same before as after because they thought it was the same.
That's correct, and we represent thousands of associations, and many of those boards are made up of lay people. They're not people that are sophisticated in the law and understand some of these nuances. So, things went by the wayside.
But once the 10-year period ended, I mean, can winding up just go on forever and you operate as if you weren't dissolved and weren't wound up, or isn't there some, doesn't have to be some meaning to the fact that you're dissolved and the fact that you're just supposed to wind up?
Well, there's meaning to it in that you need to wind up.
But apparently not if there's no time within which you have to. It could go on 100 years. I mean, and you can operate as if it weren't dissolved. And that may be what the statutes provide, but please address that for me. What's the purpose of having it?
Well, first of all, especially when it comes to these community organizations, community associations, we have, let's say in the condo field, we have a statute. And the statute says you don't have to even be incorporated. It doesn't matter. We don't care. We need three people who are on a board. And they just serve at the pleasure of the covenants and restrictions of the declaration. They serve the declaration. They don't serve their own purpose. They serve the members who have an expectation that these things are provided in their neighborhood. So the fact that they made a mistake, they didn't file with the Secretary of State, should not deprive each and every one of these members, these owners, who for years, since 1977, have received these services.
But, Councilor, my problem is this association was administratively dissolved in 92, and the property owner here, Mr. Veal, didn't acquire title till 97? And so my point is that if the board of directors and the officers are winding up the business of this corporation from the 1992 and from activities henceforth, or prior to that time, how can winding up include now assessing new property that's being acquired in the future? To me, that's not winding up, that's operating in the future.
And that's a great question. Thank you. The first of all, we don't agree that that's what the purpose of the assessments is. The assessments have nothing to do with adding new properties.
Yeah, but I'm just thinking that's a new parcel that's added on. Why would they assess this new parcel that was not part of this old association's authority? I mean, that's not winding up, is it?
When Veal bought, he bought with an indenture, filed a declaration, filed at the Recorder of Deeds office, and he knew full well, and the cases are very clear. When you buy the property subject to these covenants and restrictions, you pay assessments. You can't come in here now and say, gee, I didn't know. Well, he did know because it was a recorded document.
Couldn't he also been aware that they were no longer an association pursuant to the Secretary of State's records? Wasn't that public knowledge or public record?
Whether or not the association, at the time he bought, look, the association could have rescinded the forfeiture. They had every right to do so.
Isn't the real issue who has the authority to do it? I noticed in your statement of uncontroverted facts where you say that the original association corporation assigned all of its right to the current one. In support for that, you attach a resolution and an assignment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what did the resolution say?
The resolution said that they...
Did it say that the president has the authority to sign the assignment?
Well, I don't have it in front of me. I don't know it by heart, Judge. I don't know for sure exactly what it says, to be honest with you.
Okay. Then do you feel confident that the statute allows the former officer to sign, or does the statute require that the directors step into the shoes of the corporation for purposes of responsibilities and liabilities?
Kind of a misnomer. They don't step in the shoes of anything. They are the former officers and directors, and they become the trustees of the assets for the winding down period.
Okay.
Do they have to sign in that capacity?
Okay, but is there a distinction between the officers and the directors? That's my point.
The statute makes no distinction between officers and directors, I don't believe. But in this case, it was the president, who was clearly an officer, and said so in his
And was he also a director? Was he also a director? That's the question.
May have been. I don't know.
Well, if the statute makes the directors the ones who can wind it up.
No, the officers is
okay.
Absolutely, the officers
okay.
is in the statute as well. No question about it.
How many were there altogether?
How many
officers?
My understanding, there were three. There's always been three members of the board of the Bolivar Place Association. Always three.
And did the other ones sign?
I don't think so. I think just I don't know that they were. I don't know that they're alive. I think this guy might be the only
one. They were not alive?
Excuse me?
They were not alive?
I'm not sure that they were alive.
Hard to get them to sign them.
It would be kind of hard for them to do that.
It might also be hard to get them to agree to a resolution to allow him, the president, to sign.
It might be hard. I'm guessing it's on the record, so don't. I'd like to say one thing about this assessments issue. And if you please read the section we wrote about that, in terms of this being a typographical error, it is so clear. There is no authority in this to spend any money to accumulate properties. That section, which is Article 2, speaks only to the issue of properties coming in order to be subject to the declaration. That's the only purpose that Article 2 has, is the description of how that happens. And generally, it is the developer who will decide whether or not a property may join in and be subject to the declaration. But there's no authority for paying for properties to come in, and they don't do that.
You argue, and I'm switching you a little bit because your time is up. You argue that the association, the fact that it was not in existence during the period of time that some of these assessments were claimed to have accrued. You argue that the assessments accrued because of the language in the covenants, not because of an act by the association. Can you address that?
Well, just that when you buy, you're responsible to pay assessments. It has nothing to do with whether this appellant received the necessary services. Okay, whether he received enough services, whether he received...
And that's because of the language of the covenants.
The covenants specifically say your percentage of ownership interest is this, and this is how much you pay in assessments.
And opposing counsel's point is, what's this about it being added later, so it was not part of the original association, or this property was not part?
I don't understand that point, because he bought subject to the declaration and the covenants and restrictions when he bought. And
was this property part of the property covered by the association initially?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Absolutely.
And is there any authority addressing, if you buy it while something's dissolved, whether or not those covenants are still valid or not?
The covenants are always valid. That's the point. The point is the covenants run with the land. They're always valid.
Even if there's no one to enforce it, they're still part of it.
They're still part of the property. And so the issue here is, this is an issue of the person who's going to administer, the entity that will administer these. And so with an assignment where there's continuity, at least, from going from the developer onto the old DPA into the new DPA, there's a continuity here that's very clear, and it allows for the continuity and for the preservation of the developer's intentions. And that's why this assignment needs to be upheld. It needs to be validated at this point. Otherwise, it's an absurd result, which is all of these owners who have expectations, they all get squashed because a few who were on a board didn't re-up with the Secretary of State as they should have. And that wasn't developers. The developer couldn't anticipate everything. And in fact, you know, in this case, he didn't anticipate this happening. But we should be reading these assignments in a way that upholds the letter of the covenants and restrictions. One last second.
Thank you very much.
I get no.
Your time's
up. My time's up. Thank you.
The issue is to what the practical consequences of this, what the respondent's position is, I think deserves to be addressed to some extent. Under the respondent's construct, what could happen here is you would have somebody, which is what happened, somebody comes in and buys property. There's no way of knowing that there really is an association. The records indicate that the association, to the extent it ever existed, is not there anymore.
Mr. Kistner, can you address Mr. Berkowitz's point that, but you did buy it with declarations, being the covenants being part of the recorded information about the property, and therefore you knew it was subject to these assessments, even if there was no extant association?
Well, I think that in terms of those documents, that language may be in there, but if you also, having done the due diligence to attempt to determine what that means, you find out that, in fact, the corporate entity that is designated in those documents no longer exists, what happens is what happened with the appellant here. You assume that that is kind of a leftover from a different era and that it's defunct.
Could a new association be formed, which then you would be obligated to pay, or why is it voluntary on your part whether then you recognize its authority?
Well, I think a new neighborhood association could be formed, but if the old neighborhood association is defunct and there is not a timely assignment, then I think the practical reality is it would have to be a voluntary joinder.
And there's no effect of those covenants running with the land or being with the property if there's, it's just there, but you have to voluntarily agree to.
I think so. I mean, it seems to me that overall what the respondent advocates is a situation in which there's this unwritten caveat in the law for these associations such that they get do-overs that the law does not contemplate. The practical reality is, you know, the developer's intent puts forward that principle, that theme, but there's no real basis in the law for it.
Isn't there a kind of a corollary idea, though, that if those covenants are in the record, you know the covenants are there, that you're on inquiry notice for assessments, assignments, or who might be responsible for any outstanding amount?
Yes, I think that that is true, that you are put on notice, perhaps. And the point that we try to make in our briefs is that what do you do when you find out that there is no association that actually exists anymore?
Well, but even then, now, you'd agree that a company that who has dissolved, that has a substantial asset, something would have to happen with the asset, right? The asset would have to be dispersed in some way to someone.
If the corporation winds its affairs in accordance with the statute.
Yeah, but they haven't done that, but there's still this asset. Corporation goes out of business. This association owned a car.
Yes.
Okay. It's dissolved, time's up, there's still the car. Something has to happen with the car, right?
I think that's what the law contemplates, yes.
What's the difference between a car and a debt owed? Which is essentially the piece of property that the dissolved corporation has the debt owed by your client.
Okay. Our point is that as to a purchaser trying to figure out whether there is some debt owed or going to be owed as to a defunct entity is difficult to ascertain. That
why wouldn't a
car, first of all. I apologize, but
no problem.
It probably would not be important to a purchaser to make that inquiry, and I'm probably missing some point, Your Honor, but I don't even know how the layperson purchaser would even figure that out.
Well, you've got a title policy that probably reflects it, does it not?
It reflects what?
The title policy would reflect the association having an interest in the real estate. The property is subject to an assessment. And by the way, is the assessment stated as an amount in the papers that were filed of record with the Register of Deeds?
I don't think so. No.
Is it the title policy in the record?
No, it's not.
But did in buying it, I mean, was there something showing this assessment was due and owing on the property at the time of purchase? Because normally you do owe those when they're back, or is it your position there was not?
Not at the time of the purchase in 1997.
It didn't show that there were back assessments due.
No.
So there was not a debt in your view.
Right.
Did it show how much was assessed against each piece of property? Wasn't there a schedule as to the amount that your client would know would be assessed as homeowners or as property owner's fees?
I'm not going to commit to that, Your Honor, but to the extent that such a thing existed, again, even if there were a schedule to this particular purchase, to a purchaser, one would not know if that had any efficacy, given the fact that the entity responsible for collecting those assessments had ceased to exist.
Well, and let me, that's the question I want to get to, because I think it's important. If you were asked the question by your client prior to the purchase, you would tell them that they're subject to the declarations, whatever they are, but that if the corporate charter is rescinded, that there are those that are in charge of the company. As I understand it, you say what gets you out of that trick bag is the time for them to rescind their charter expired. But certainly in 97, you would have advised the client that, well, they have this much time to wind up, but if they don't get their charter rescinded, would you have told them that nobody had the authority to collect the debt? Would you have told them that the former officers and directors are in charge?
As of 97, my legal advice would have been in this situation that somebody would have the ability to collect the assessments during the winding up process, that after 2002, that might even continue, but that as a matter of fact, here we don't have that situation, Your Honor, because it's all predicated on this purported assignment that postdated the 10-year period, that being ineffective and invalid. I think that the question you're asking is not critical to the outcome to this case. I understand it's an interesting issue, and it goes to the question as to whether or not this winding up process continues indefinitely, which I think academically and perhaps on the back of another case might be appropriate. I mean, I'm not sitting at the bench, but I mean, the point is I'm not sure that is squarely presented by this case.
Well, if the assignment is invalid, do the former officers and trustees still own the claim?
Again, I'm not sure that because the pleadings do not raise the issue of whether what we call the ODPA still would have authority to collect the assessments. We don't have the ODPA in this court. So I'm not sure. I have not given that a lot of thought.
Does the record show if assessments were made but unpaid during this period from 92 on? Or when were assessments first made against the property that were unpaid?
As to my client's property? Mm-hmm. Well, the record indicates kind of retrospectively that there were assessments made back to 98 because they've attempted to collect them. But, I mean, in terms of, are you asking whether there was somebody each year who was actually making an assessment?
Right.
Yeah, I'm not sure I know the answer to that question.
Did your client get the minutes and bylaws to the association at the time of purchase?
The record doesn't have any indication that he got the minutes or the bylaws. As a matter of fact, the bylaws are not in the record, and we think that the absence of any information, any documentation as to the bylaws is a problem in this case because, again, you would have to look at the bylaws to determine whether, in fact, this purported assignment was done validly.
And it was the association's motion for summary judgment.
That's correct, and we believe that was part of its burden. We look at this situation in terms of the, you know, the Rule 7404, in terms of assertions and rebuttal, talk about facts. It's assertions of fact and your obligation to dispute material facts. It's not stating legal conclusions in separately numbered paragraphs and then in corresponding separately numbered paragraphs refuting those legal conclusions. And that goes to the...
Are there any further questions?
I have one more. Did your client pay the assessments during the period where you claim the association was not properly assigned them on other property he owned?
Well, we claim that
they... Did he pay them without protest?
Again, we claim that there was never an assignment. But, yes, there was a period of time, I think it was... whether it was 1 or 2 years, 2002, 2003, I think he made one payment. We take the position that that was done by mistake. The fact that he made one payment does not stop him or constitute an admission. It actually was simply done before he awakened. Again, I see my time is up. The appellant requests that this court reverse the summary judgment entered in favor of the respondent at the trial court level.
Thank you.
Can I just correct Mr. Elton on one point that he just made? Can I just do that? 2 seconds. Mr. Veal did pay for a period of 8 years for another property in the association. So
case is taken under submission. Thank you.